From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we help you ease into the new year with the music of Dawn Upshaw. In the world of opera, she's known for her lack of pretentiousness. Her latest album features songs from musicals by Bernstein, Blitzstein, Sondheim, and Weill. Also, an interview with Ian Fraser about his latest book, Family. It was listed as one of the 10 best books of 1994 by Time magazine and Entertainment Weekly. The book is a family history that Fraser began after the death of his parents when he began searching for a meaning that would defeat death. And I'm sure you don't want to be bored in 1995, but you may be interested in reading a book about the history of boredom. Maureen Carrigan has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Fierce fighting is continuing in Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, but Moscow now admits the rebels have destroyed many Russian tanks. Russian troops have retreated to wait for reinforcements. The Russians have claimed they've surrounded the presidential palace, but the BBC's Steve McCormack has been there, and he says Chechen forces are still in control.
The center of Grozny, including the presidential palace, has throughout the day been in the complete control of the Chechens. In fact, a row of Chechen flags hanging on poles on one side of the square and a large one fluttering in the wind on top of the palace itself suggests the Russians have never once yet been in any position of strength in this symbolic part of the city, which runs contrary to the claims which have been coming out of the Kremlin in the last 24 hours. When I walked inside the palace, which is pitted on the outside by heavy machine gun fire, but otherwise still structurally sound, I was confronted by confident Chechen soldiers, proud to have repelled the Russian advance. The scene in front of the building is one of devastation. Everywhere are signs of heavy bomb damage, broken glass, crumbled masonry, lampposts and telephone wires strewn across the square.
Steve McCormack reporting. Bosnian Croats are now bound by a new ceasefire agreement. A Croat leader signed the truce today in the southern town of Mostar. UN peacekeeping commander Michael Rose had initiated the talks. Rose says he's glad to have signatures from three sides in the Bosnian fighting. The four-month agreement has been signed earlier by the Muslim-led Bosnian government and rebel Serbian forces. A tugboat crew in the North Pacific has recaptured the container ship Hyundai Seattle. The crippled ship broke free of a tow line over the weekend in rough seas off the Washington coast. From member station KUOW, Robert Smith reports.
A helicopter lowered a crew onto the deserted container ship last night to attach a new tow line. The Hyundai Seattle had been drifting in rough seas and high winds since Saturday when a heavy storm snapped a steel cable from a tugboat pulling the ship. The tow line recoiled and hit the chief mate of the tugboat, who was airlifted to a hospital with a cut leg and broken collarbone. The tugboat was sent to salvage the Hyundai Seattle after an engine room fire disabled the ship off the Alaskan coast. The crew was evacuated and the ship abandoned. If the tugboat can get the ship to a safe harbor, the tugboat company can keep the vessel. The two ships are expected to arrive in Seattle in the next couple of days. For National Public Radio, this is Robert Smith reporting.
Marion Barry is mayor of Washington, D.C. again. Barry took the oath of office today, 4 years after he left the mayoralty in disgrace and served 6 months in prison for a drug conviction. Barry is urging his supporters and opponents to get to the roots of the city's severe fiscal and crime problems. Barry says he has redeemed himself with help from God. He says if he can recover, so can the city. This is NPR News. French swimmer Guy Delage has made it a quarter of the way across the Atlantic Ocean. He's towing a raft behind him as he swims. As of New Year's Day, Delage swam 652 miles since he set out December 16th from the island of Cape Verde off the northwest African coast. The entire trip to the West Indies is projected at 2,440 miles. Delage, who's 42, is paddling across the Atlantic with specially designed flippers and a wetsuit. He holds a flotation device and has supplies on his raft. Former Somali President Mohamed Siad Barre has died. He's been in exile in Nigeria since 1992. His son reports he died of natural causes. The BBC's Sarah Stanzer reports.
General Mohamed Siad Barre's long and dictatorial rule, through 21 years of famine and sporadic insurrection in Somalia, came to an ignominious conclusion in January 1991, when he was forced into exile, fleeing the capital Mogadishu in a tank. He'd become president 21 years earlier, taking power in a bloodless coup and quickly establishing intermittent control of a country made up of warring clans. A catastrophic defeat in the war with Ethiopia in the late 1970s, coupled with droughts, several coup attempts, and a near-fatal car crash, made his dictatorship one of the most unstable in Africa.
Sarah Stanzer reporting. North Korea says some 40 world leaders have exchanged New Year's greetings with Kim Jong-il. It's the latest report by the communist state to end speculation over Kim's health and control on power. The North has also released a photograph of the reclusive leader. Kim hasn't been seen in public since July when he attended the funeral of his father. New rumors broke out yesterday when the younger Kim failed to make a traditional New Year's Day speech. Kim is 52 and had been groomed to take over from his father. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year. We have some wonderful music to help you get 1995 off to a good start. When an opera singer takes on Broadway songs, it often means trouble. That's why Dawn Upshaw's recent recording of show tunes is such a surprise. Then again, Upshaw is such an unassuming opera singer, headlines have referred to her as the undiva and the diva next door. Her latest album, I Wish It So, features songs by Leonard Bernstein, Mark Blitzstein, Stephen Sondheim, and Kurt Weill. She's already won 2 Grammy Awards for her 1989 album of songs by Samuel Barber and John Harbison, and for her 1991 album, The Girl with Orange Lips, a collection of songs by Ravel, Stravinsky, and Earl Kim. We'll feature the interview I recorded with her last fall after we hear the title track from her album, I Wish It So.
An unrest inside me. Oh, it's long I have had such an unrest inside me, and it's getting real bad. I'm sleeping at night, and my heart beats so loud that I wake all dizzy and light with a dreaming and feeling this. Such a thumping inside me that I think I'll go mad. For I wish it so, what I wish I still don't know, but it's bound to come, though so long to wait.
Dawn Upshaw, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Now, the song that we just heard is by Mark Blitzstein, who I know basically from, you know, as the translator of Brecht's lyrics for the Three Penny Opera. I know he wrote The Cradle Will Rock. I don't know the music. And this is such a beautiful song. It was really a revelation to me.
Yeah.
To hear it. So first I want to thank you for recording it and then for doing it so well. What made you choose this?
Well, I had heard it on a recording when I was became interested in looking into some Mark Blitzstein music. I heard a recording of lots of different songs, and this one touched me more than any other, and has become quite an important song altogether for me. I think it has a wonderful message, and that's why I really chose it to sort of open the entire recording and gave the recording this title.
How did you narrow down your record to 4 composers?
We thought it might be interesting to take these 4 composers who had all written for opera and music theater and had similar things in common in terms of their backgrounds and what they were trying to do in American music theater. So the challenge was narrowing down all the songs because there are so many wonderful songs. But we did want to choose maybe, for the most part, some that hadn't been heard all that often.
I'm one of the people who gets kind of scared when I hear that an opera singer is going to do Broadway songs. Because with the exception of
say, Eileen Farrell, so many opera singers have stiff phrasing and very pretentious pronunciations, and they seem to almost be condescending to the material. Mm-hmm. And you sing with a directness and a colloquialism that I think, you know, pop or Broadway really requires, but you have the sureness of a wonderful and trained singer. Were you used to singing this material?
I did a fair amount of it, you know, in high school, but I'm sure most of my colleagues did. I guess I've always tried to stick close to my love for lyrics and for words. And sometimes I think that perhaps I'm viewed by my own audiences in opera and in the classical world as being a little too relaxed in that sense. And maybe I was able to approach these words a little bit more naturally and comfortably because of that. But I really do always work from the text, and that's what brings me to new music, that my interest in a particular song.
Let me pause here to play another of the songs from your new album. Why don't we hear That's Him, which is a collaboration between Kurt Weill and Ogden Nash. Tell me why you chose this song.
I love these lyrics. They're so much fun. And I just thought it was a beautiful, you know, an old gem kind of just a wonderful style that I actually miss nowadays in songs. I didn't know this song before. My friend Tommy Krasker showed it to me, and I fell in love with it, had to do it.
Okay, I'm glad you did. This is Dawn Upshaw from her new album, I Wish It So.
You know the way you feel when there is autumn in the air. That's him. That's him. The way you feel when Antoine has finished with your hair. That's him. That's him. You know the way you feel when you smell bread baking. The way you feel when suddenly a tooth stops aching. Wonderful world. Wonderful you. That's him. That's him. He is as simple as a swim in summer.
Dawn Upshaw, do you think you use your voice differently when you're singing Broadway songs and when you're singing opera? Is there a different range, for instance, that you're in?
Oh, definitely. A much different vocal range. Just in terms of the lower, it's a much lower range. I'm using more of my middle and lower notes than I do in opera and other classical music. But I really like to think that in terms of producing the sound, I'm not doing much differently. I think what is the primary difference is the way I use words and perhaps use the consonants and the vowels. In order to sound as natural as possible. Now, hearing myself say that, I think, geez, I should do that all the time, whether I'm singing classical music or music theater. But anyway, I felt like everything needed to be very accessible, the diction especially.
So what's the difference between the way you pronounce consonants and vowels in opera and the way you do with music theater?
I guess I give myself a little bit more liberty in the music theater to express and maybe spend a little bit more time on consonants, for instance. It becomes more important, depending on what style you're singing in, but say Mozart, to sing more legato, and so much of the way the music is written and a phrase is turned depends on singing on vowel longer than necessarily, you know, playing with consonants.
Yeah, I think a lot of classical singers are appalled at the way pop singers sing the consonants. Mm-hmm. I mean, consonants are supposed to just end the vowel, right?
Well, except I find that it's the consonants that really make a singer, you know, individual from another singer, because you can be so expressive with a consonant. I find that it's much more difficult to be expressive with a vowel, you know.
Is there any way you could demonstrate for us what you mean?
Sure. One of the songs, that's him. I'm trying to say, you know the way you feel when there is autumn in the air. That's him. That's him. And when I sing that's him, I think that the M can show everybody how much I love him. I can enjoy, almost like I'm eating a delicious fruit. I can enjoy that M. And what I might do if it were Mozart, although I'm not certain about this, but I think, you know, that I might dwell more on the vowel and less on the M.
And how would that sound?
And that's him. That's him. You know.
Right. Something. Right.
Much less interesting, isn't it?
I want to quote something from Opera News. The article said about you that you are one of the most hotly debated young singers. Mm. Your talent is not in question, but opinion is divided over what exactly is the best place for you, the opera or the recital hall on the concert stage. Now, that was written even before you started doing music theater repertoire. So, you know, how does it feel to be the subject of debate about where, you know, where you most belong?
Well, you know, if I can get people out of any kind of funk that might be out there and thinking a little bit differently, I'm happy for it. I think that sometimes the classical music world and the opera world can be a little bit stiff, and I have trouble with it myself sometimes. So if this challenges them at all, that's fine with me.
I imagine people are kind of competing for your attention now, in the sense that, like, I want to urge you to do more material, like on your new album, you know, more music theater material, whereas I'm sure opera fans are trying to pull you more in an opera direction.
It's difficult. I mean, I think when you say that about my family, my parents grew up much more with folk music and music theater. In fact, they were involved and sort of dragged me along to do some community theater when I was living at home, at least. And they were involved in musicals. And so when I went off into the classical world, they were very good about trying to follow and keep up with me and stuff. But once I did this recording, you know, I could tell they felt like, oh, you've come back home to us. And, you know, this is it. This is the recording we've been waiting for, which leaves me feeling a little bit funny sometimes.
How so?
Well, I think, you know, I love my work. I don't pick up any project that I'm not very interested in and committed to. I think what I will do is, I do love variety, and Lord knows I have a lot of variety in my life, not just musically, but in terms of my family life and my kids, and that's what makes life interesting. So I will continue to add this new music, this music theater and things in that direction to my work.
Dawn Upshaw is my guest. She has a new recording of songs from Broadway called I Wish It So. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dawn Upshaw. Her new album of songs for music theater is called I Wish It So. You sing on the Symphony No. 3 by Henrik Gorecki, which was recorded, a couple of years ago? And
yes.
It became this phenomenon. It was a really big seller in the United States. It made it onto the top 10, the pop top 10 in England.
Right.
Did you have any sense that it would be that kind of phenomenon when you recorded it?
No. None at all. It was a complete surprise, really, to all of us involved, which is not to say that we didn't all have very profound experiences as we recorded it. We did. We just never expected so wide an audience in the world to have that same experience themselves.
I want to play a short excerpt of this symphony since it's sung in Polish. Tell us a little bit about what the symphony is about.
Well, it really has a lot to do with the composer, Mr. Gorecki's experience with the Second World War and all of the various people who were killed in the concentration camps. And he lived not very far from Auschwitz and had actually visited some of the camps. And as you can imagine, this had quite an effect on him. He chose some texts for this piece. It's called the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. They're really religious texts and all have to do with loss. Two of them have to do with losing a mother losing her son, and the middle movement has to do with something he had read that was actually engraved in a prison wall by a 14-year-old girl, which stated when she had been imprisoned, and a message to her mother to please not cry for her, that Mother Mary would take care of her. And it's not known whether she survived. I think it's assumed that she did not survive, this young girl. They're very touching texts, and the music is extremely simple in a sense, but so profound and rich and expressive. And every movement is slow. And what is so amazing to me is that this is a piece that just stretches out for such a long time, and yet it has grabbed and kept and held the attention of so many listeners and has touched so many people.
Let's hear a little bit of it. This is Henryk Gorecki, Symphony No. 3. The singer is my guest, Dawn Upshaw, and we'll hear David Zinman conducting the London Sinfonietta. Dawn Upshaw performing Henryk Gorecki's Symphony No. 3. What were the first kinds of songs that you listened to as a girl?
I listened to a lot of folk music, and my father played guitar, and my mother both my parents sing a bit, and my sister and I, when we were very young, went with them, and the four of us sang for students, for little kids in school. And we always had kind of a bit of a message, and it was during civil rights movement and in the early 60s. And that's what I grew up with, and I studied piano, I studied the oboe, and I guess it was through those two instruments that my musical background had broadened a little bit, but I didn't really hear any classical music in my home until I was ready to go to college.
I guess that's kind of late for someone who ended up singing opera.
I think so. It is a little bit late. But it's interesting because I remember the moment it all grabbed me. And it wasn't opera that grabbed me right away, but it was some very early music. I was listening to some choral music of Josquin, which is Renaissance music. And I was just blown away at how this piece had been put together. It was an onomatopoeic piece about war. And so the singers were making all of these sounds of the guns and the cannons and lots of contrapuntal writing. It was fascinating.
I know there was a time when you wanted to sing jingles.
<'Cause>, yes.
Well, I guess you can make a living simply that way.
Yes, it seemed pretty good to me. I was working as a secretary in a studio where they recorded jingles one summer between years in high school. And these singers would come in. I mean, they had to be able to read anything at sight, of course, and to sing in any style. Or I guess frequently they invite different singers based on what they sound like, what they need for their commercials. But they would come in, and I mean, in the matter of 15 to 30 minutes, put down a jingle, and somebody told me how much they got paid at that time, the top singers. I don't know, it was something like $500,000 a year or something. And I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, it's terrible to hear me talking this way now, but I thought, gee, that sounds like a good living to me.
was there a certain kind of jingle you could imagine yourself singing?
Well, there was one of my favorites that I heard while I was working, which is, I'll give a plug right now for Kalamazoo, Michigan. It was about Kalamazoo, and it said, "Yes, there really is a Kalamazoo, so much to offer you." I don't know, I really liked the tune, and I thought this would be really fun, you know. Somehow I got distracted. I don't know that I would never consider doing that, but I guess other things have caught my eye since.
Oh, well, something to fall back on.
Perhaps.
Dawn Upshaw recorded last September. She's currently starring in the Metropolitan Opera's production of The Marriage of Figaro. Upshaw's latest recording, I Wish It So, features songs by Bernstein, Blitzstein, Sondheim, and Weill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Take me to the world that's real. Show me how it's done. Teach me how to laugh, to feel. Move me to the sun. Just hold my hand whenever we arrive. Take me to the world where I can be
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After the death of his parents, writer Ian Fraser took solace in the things they left behind. His father's meal tickets from college, his mother's purses, and the letters they saved, which dated back as far as 1855. Coming up, Fraser tells us how these things led him to trace his family history. It's the subject of his book, Family. Time magazine listed it as one of the 10 best books of 1994. And critic Maureen Carrigan reviews a new book that's about boredom, but isn't boring. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Former Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry has returned to lead his city as mayor after a four-year absence, including jail time for a drug conviction. UPI's Carol Van Dam prepared this report.
And the public interest.
And the public interest.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
It is a new day for Marion Barry and District of Columbia residents as Barry is sworn into office for the fourth time in his incredible career. It was just 4 years ago that Barry left the mayor's office in disgrace on a cocaine conviction. To his credit, Barry revitalized the downtown area when businesses were leaving in droves a decade ago. Now, as he inherits a $500 million budget deficit and residents flock to the suburbs, Barry faces the toughest challenge of his political life. Sounding his familiar theme of redemption, Barry is asking D.C. residents, reporters and Congress to give him a second chance. Carol Van Dam, Washington.
President Clinton is in Arkansas for a brief visit. He's expected to meet a crowd at the Little Rock Airport and attend a reception with friends this evening. He'll dedicate the William Jefferson Clinton Elementary School tomorrow. The first family spent the weekend in Hilton Head, South Carolina, attending the Renaissance Weekend. This is a policy retreat held for leaders from several walks of life. This is the 11th year the Clintons have attended the gathering. Egypt's Interior Ministry says suspected Muslim militants have killed at least 11 police officers in 5 different attacks in southern Egypt. All of the attacks took place within an hour of each other. 3 civilians were also killed and 2 other police officers were wounded. The BBC's Stephen Sacker reports.
After a coup brought Siad Barre to power in 1969, he used military muscle supplied in turn by the former Soviet Union.
Gunmen escaped with weapons taken from the dead man.
We'll have more on that report shortly. Syria has a statement blaming Israel for the latest deadlock in peace talks. Syrian state media says the government is still holding out hope that Mideast peace can be reached this year. But Syria says Israel is still refusing to implement United Nations resolutions. Syria wants the return of the strategic Golan Heights, which Israel seized during the 1967 Six-Day War. Israel has called for a measured, timely pullout, which Syria rejects. A leader of the Jewish settlers says he'll fight an Israeli restriction on a planned settlement expansion. The leader says supporters will occupy the disputed expansion site in the West Bank. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has stopped the expansion. He says the action is necessary to keep the peace with Palestinians. The Palestinians claim the land has been theirs for generations and that it was taken from them illegally. The government's proposed compromise calls for expansion on another site. Palestinians officials reject this idea. This is NPR. Former Somali President Mohamed Siad Barre has died in exile in Nigeria. Siad Barre ruled Somalia as dictator for most of his 22 years in power. He was forced out in 1991. Jane Stanley reports.
After a coup brought Siad Barre to power in 1969, he used military muscle, supplied in turn by the former Soviet Union and the United States, to ruthlessly cling on to power. The weapons he acquired were used to crush mounting internal opposition. Using his skills as a master manipulator, Siad Barre diluted the power of his rivals by emphasizing the traditional antagonisms of Somalia's feuding clans. Opposition forces did come together briefly in January 1991 for the final push on Mogadishu, which toppled him from power. After several months trying to fight back, he finally went into exile in Nigeria. Behind him he left chaos as the clans turned on each other, prompting one of the worst famines in recent history and continuing factional warfare in Somalia. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Standley in Nairobi.
Police say a detained man who's believed to have killed two people at two Massachusetts women's health clinics is calm in his Norfolk, Virginia cell. John Salvi will appear in court tomorrow on charges of shooting at a Norfolk clinic that performs abortions. No one was hurt in that incident, but he'll also be returned to the Boston area to face the murder charges and charges that he hurt five people. Norfolk jail authorities say a small group of anti-abortion activists gathered outside the jail to support Salvi. They shouted encouragement to him through a megaphone. Meanwhile, incoming Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says the attacks might be a sign that clinics need more federal protection. Authorities in the West Bank say Israeli troops have shot and killed three Palestinians in two incidents. One came in a village near Hebron, where the army says its troops raided two houses. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After Ian Frazier's parents died, he hoped to find a meaning that would defeat their death. He hunted for that meaning in the objects they saved, an old hymnal, a black mesh hat veil, photographs, and letters. He hoped that by tracing each object to its source, he could find a larger meaning. He took on the mission of finding a narrative that linked together the objects his parents had saved and to link that narrative to the larger story of American history. The result is his book, Family. It was number 4 on Time magazine's list of the best books of 1994. I spoke with Frazier last fall when the book was published. Frazier is a regular contributor to The New Yorker and the author of Dating Your Mom and The Great Plains. When he started collecting his parents' possessions, he divided them into boxes, which he labeled the Dad Museum and the Mom Museum. Suddenly, he was a curator, but he had no training for this job.
I didn't know what was of value and what wasn't. I was sort of an archaeologist without any sort of direction. I just had all this stuff, and I regarded it all as artifacts, and I tried to make sense of what it was. And sometimes, after looking at something for a really long time, I would conclude that there wasn't any meaning to it really at all, except that someone had forgotten to throw it away. Other times, an object would expand in meaning and practically take over all the other meanings. So I felt the responsibility of an archaeologist or maybe a paleontologist putting something together from just a few fragments.
What kinds of things had your parents saved?
Oh, just everything. My father's meal ticket from Boys State in Columbus, Ohio in 1934. Why save the meal ticket? There were 28 out of 30 punches were punched, and two weren't. All kinds of things, programs from plays that they had seen or had been in. Lots and lots of letters, as I say in the book, just a cache of letters. Going back, in some cases, there were letters that went back into the 19th century. I think the earliest actual letter that I had went back to 1855, was written in 1855. And just strange things, you know, purses. My mother saved every purse for some reason, never threw out a purse. And I was able to trace the history of purses in America from 1945 to 1988 just by lining these purses up on the floor.
Your family was part of some of the major movements in American history, the move west,
mm-hmm.
the Civil War. Your great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather.
Right, two greats. Mm-hmm.
Charlie Wickham became the second in command of the 55th Regiment?
That's right, the 55th Ohio Volunteer Infantry, which I read the book about the 55th, which was written in the early, in 1904. And I became so involved in this regiment. They were all guys from the Norwalk area, Norwalk, Ohio. And it was sort of a hometown regiment, and I got to feel that I knew all these guys. And when you see somebody, kind of a small-town kid who suddenly finds himself in this unbelievable war, it was just fascinating to me. And it was also fascinating, I think, because of what those guys did. They were, many of them, very idealistic, and they truly suffered for 5 years. I can't imagine that type of suffering. And at the end, they had changed the country. They had actually done something with this suffering, and the country had done something with the suffering that it went through. And I think when you look at the country and you think, how will we ever fix all of these disastrous problems that we seem to have, and you realize we have fixed problems. We have fixed problems in the past. And so somehow it was a very hopeful saga for me to follow the Civil War.
Your great-great-grandfather survived the Battle of Chancellorsville.
Right.
This is a battle where the Union troops lost about 17,000 killed, wounded, or captured, and the Confederates about 13,000. This was just a couple of months before Gettysburg. But you write that by the time you were born, the deeds of the 55th had been forgotten. How did that make you feel to think about that, how all of that had been forgotten, something so cataclysmic, and you were born and never gave it a thought until you started investigating your family history?
I thought it should be remembered. I thought it should be revived as something people know about. The people who were born after the Civil War, I think, had had enough of it, enough of hearing about it. Just like maybe people my age got a little sick of hearing about the Depression. And I think that they assisted in forgetting it. It was just the way that you don't want to hear something from your parents all the time. I think they got a little sick of it. And when I read about the 55th, and when I read about what the regiment had done in the war, it helped me to understand where I grew up a lot more, because I could see that there was a certain optimism and a certain dedication to the American idea that came from this, from their participation in the war. So also, the war was just really an amazing event, and there are people who get fascinated by it, and I'm one of those people, sort of a buff.
My guest is Ian Fraser. His new book is a family history called Family. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ian Fraser, the author of A New Family History Called Family. Now, where did your search for your family history take you, and what are some of the things that you did during that search that were really out of character for you?
Well, it took me mainly to small towns in the Midwest and in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, places like that. It took me also to the coasts, east and west, because most of my family has dispersed from the middle of the country to the edges, again following a population pattern that was big and has been big in recent times. So I went all over little towns, and what was the most out of character thing I did? I suppose for me at the time, really thinking a lot about religion. It just hadn't been part of my consciousness, really. And to read these books from the 19th century where people are disputing rather small points of Protestant belief and practice, it was sort of a mind-bending experience to try and figure out, you know, exactly what the difference between, say, the New School Presbyterians and the Old School Presbyterians, a distinction now lost, but in 1825 very important. That it was stuff like that that was really kind of confusing and hard to follow.
Yeah, well, you write you come from a long line of Protestants, but the portion of doubt increased down the generations. I guess you're part of the generation that has plenty of doubt.
Oh, yeah. Doubt is the new religion, I guess, or it's the new standard of something that you can count on everybody pretty much having inside them, and doubts. Doubt sort of has a public persona of irony, and irony is the lingua franca of people that of many, many people. And to me, irony gets kind of old after a while. And I just wanted to see what it was like to be in this different frame of mind where doubt might perhaps be quite a bit smaller, where your faith was very strong.
You also reflect on how your ancestors rarely married outside their denomination. Mm-hmm. But in your generation, everyone in your family seems to be marrying outside.
Right.
Spouses, you know, people have married spouses who are Catholic, Jewish, Italian, Greek, African. Same faith marriages in your family now are the exception. Do you feel that that's good or bad or neutral or just a, you know, sign of the times?
Well, I think it's very good. I like it. I like variety. And I grew up, I think, in a situation where I craved more variety. So I think it's, you know, I think it's really great. It's also historically part of what happened in this century, which is the ecumenical movement, that is people sort of concentrating on what made them the same rather than what made them different. And I often felt like when I was reading 19th century newspapers, my ancestors edited the newspaper in Norwalk, Ohio, and a 19th century paper in a small town in Ohio, if a strange person came to town, there would be a little parenthesis after identifying that person by race or religion. So it would say, you know, John Martinelli, parenthesis, Italian, was in town last week for such a... Well, or, you know, Moses Smith, parenthesis, colored. Well, sometimes I would get out of the 19th century when I'd been doing really deep research. I would get out of it and return to this century with just the feeling of the greatest relief, that there's something really claustrophobic about the culture of that time. And I prefer my own time. That's the kind of irony of it, I guess, is that I envy their faith, but I prefer my time.
My guest is Ian Frazier, and he's written a family history called Family. As you wrote in your book, your whole search for family history was about trying to find a meaning that would defeat death, particularly that would defeat the death of your parents and your brother. I'd like to ask you to read a paragraph from the end of the book that has to do with whether you found that meaning or not.
My parents would accompany me through a life that would be much like theirs, and at every step, I would compare myself, especially to him, my father, would judge if I was doing better or worse than he had done at being middle class and putting kids through school and not terrorizing my family and staying between the lines while trying not to forget what it is I actually want to do. And unknown things would happen, and sooner or later I would die too. I understood that now, clearly, the way you suddenly become aware of the sky and the diving board after the person in front of you has jumped. And my kids perhaps would see me off as I had seen my parents off, or perhaps not. And soon all the people who had accompanied me through life would be gone too, and then even the people who had known us, and no one would remain on earth who had ever seen us, and those descended from us perhaps would know stories about us, perhaps once in a while they would pass by buildings where we had lived, and they would mention that we had lived there. And then the stories would fade, and our graves would go untended, and the graves of those who had tended ours would go untended, and no one would guess what it had been like to wake before dawn in our breath-warmed bedrooms as the radiators clanked and our wives and husbands and children slept. And we would move from the nearer regions of the dead who are remembered into the farther regions of the forgotten and on past those into a space as white and big as the sky replicated forever. And all that would remain would be the love bravely expressed and the moment when you danced and your heart danced with you.
It's a really beautiful, beautiful paragraph. You know, sometimes when people do their family history, what they really want is a sense of identity, a better sense of who they are
mm-hmm.
and how they got to be who they are. Was that an issue for you?
Yeah, I think it definitely was. I think I wanted to stop any kind of slide toward forgetting. I felt like there are people who forget in every generation, and they're important. You have to have people who forget and people who throw away. Those are people who, they start fresh, and you got to start fresh all the time. But somebody's got to save and somebody's got to remember. And I feel like I remembered enough to hold us for a while and to kind of get an idea of what it was like to invent oneself here. I mean, America was just self-invention from the beginning. And this is, in a way, it's a history of an identity as it changed from sort of the founding of the country until today.
Now that your book is finished, what are you doing with your mom and dad museums?
Well, they're just still in my office. I don't know what I'll do with them. I suppose I'll just put them somewhere and keep them. And I imagine my children will not have the courage to throw them out, although I can't quite promise that. But eventually some Genghis Khan in the line will throw everything into the flames.
So you've got the stuff just in boxes?
Yeah, it's in my office. Yeah, and it's just, and I open it up sometimes, and it's all just the same stuff. I mean, looking at it and writing it down in notebooks and labeling it and everything, and it's still the same. Yeah, I mean, I didn't kind of take the magic or the energy or whatever inhabits those boxes, still inhabits it. And when you look at it, you can still get a feeling for the people who wrote these letters or who saved these things.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome.
Ian Frazier is author of the new book, Family. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, we'll talk to NPR's Anne Garrels. She is staying on the border of Chechnya, and she has been in Grozny, a situation she describes as dangerous and incredibly dirty. They've had a thaw, and their burnt-out tanks, she says, mired in the mud in the town. We'll also be talking about drugs. Heroin use is up, particularly among young people. And we have a Susan Stamberg piece, a new piece of music, a setting of a Willa Cather novella called The Lost Lady. That's all later today on All Things Considered.
I'm sure you don't want to be bored in 1995, but you may be interested in a new book about the history of boredom. Maureen Carrigan has a review of Boredom, A Literary History of a Lethargic State of Mind by Patricia Meyer Spax.
It takes a brave author to entitle a book Boredom. Imagine the temptation a title like that offers disgruntled reviewers. Boredom exquisitely replicates the state of mind it attempts to explore. Or better yet, a succinct, onomatopoeic. But alas, I must consign these opening lines to limbo because boredom is a blast. Patricia Meyer Spax has written a rigorous, witty study of a state of mind that lots of us assume has always been a constant of the human condition. Instead, Spax claims that boredom is a fairly recent social construction, dating from the mid-18th century. Spax, who's a well-respected scholar of 18th-century literature and women's studies, edged into the trendy field of cultural studies with her last book, Gossip. She narrows down the yawning subject of boredom by looking at how it's been represented in British literature over the past 300 years. Spax also examines how oscillating ideas about what is or is not boring have continually reshaped readers' judgments about what makes a good book. For instance, Samuel Richardson's three-volume moralistic novel, The History of Sir Charles Grandison, was a runaway hit in 1753. Now it's considered a surefire snooze fest. Throughout her own book, Spax demonstrates that those who study the boring needn't become so themselves. Spax begins by delving into the etymology of the verb to bore, which popped up in English after 1750. Before then, something like the classic satire by Horace, now known as the bore, might have been translated as the impertinent. Among the causes Spax suggests for the appearance of the word boredom were the new split between work and leisure and the rise of individualism. To illustrate how being bored has meant different things at different times, Spax turns to those loquacious literary buddies, Samuel Johnson and James Boswell. Whereas the older Johnson blames himself for the vacuities of his being, Boswell finds more fault with the world. Cranky Boswell anticipates our modern responses to boredom because he regards it as a state others inflict upon him. For 18th century women, however, boredom was verboten. After all, bored women were dangerous. Left to their own devices, they might do something really reckless, like read or write a novel. In the engrossing central chapters of her book, Spax investigates how Gothic novels especially offered middle and upper-class women ways to relieve and covertly represent the boredom of their lives. Boredom surfaces even more boldly in women's private writing. This snippet from the young Fanny Burney's diaries dramatizes why many women of the period were in need of a thrill. Burney writes, "So it is, and so it seems likely to be, that I am to pass my days in the dullest of dull things, insipid, calm, uninterrupted quiet." A few lines later, Burney records the sound of the supper bell. It's clearly the highlight of her day. Throughout boredom, Spax cites many definitions of the condition, but none better than her own. Boredom, she says, presents itself as a trivial emotion that can trivialize the world. Spax demonstrates why, to a curious and creative scholar, nothing is ever too trivial.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Boredom by Patricia Meyer Spax. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After becoming famous for her humorous writing, Fran Lebowitz became famous for her writer's block. Now she's finally back at work on a novel. On the next Fresh Air, Fran Lebowitz talks about writing and not writing. And we talk with Anne Lamott about her new book of advice for writers. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.